From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the evolution of medical ethics. We'll have a conversation with doctor and author Baron Lerner.
Later, a Milwaukee writer hopes that children of all backgrounds will start to see themselves in children's literature, including in her new book.
And we hope that this book will be a positive and have a positive impact on the lives of young people. But we also know that this book alone isn't going to change the trajectory, right? This book alone is going to be part of a much bigger opportunity.
And a new cookbook from Milwaukee-based Taste of Home makes the case for spending more time with your family around the dinner table this year.
The meal itself isn't necessarily the main problem or objective. What you want to do is sit down together, talk about your day, open up communications, make memories, things like that.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. A visit to the doctor's office can sometimes be an uncomfortable experience, physically, but also when it comes to mental health.
Dr. Baron Lerner sparked a lot of discussion among the readers of the New York Times last August. Lerner is a doctor and a professor of medicine and population health at New York University. In his contribution to the Times Well blog, Lerner wrote about conflicting approaches when it comes to doctors discussing obesity with their patients. He is very upfront about it. Others approach it differently.
Lerner has written a lot of thought-provoking work, starting in 2001 with his book, The Breast Cancer Wars: Hope, Fear, and the Pursuit of a Cure in 20th Century America. He's published 5 books in total, including his most recent called The Good Doctor: A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics.
He was also asked to share his thoughts last fall with students and faculty at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where he was the 2016 Medical Humanities Lecturer. Lerner talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about where he believes our lives intersect with medical ethics.
The easy way to understand it is sort of doing the right thing. And in medical ethics, it would be when you're confronted with an issue at the bedside, particularly a doctor with a patient. How do you make sure that the various issues involved, which can often be very complicated and controversial, get boiled down to a patient-centered approach, and how can you try as a doctor to understand what your patient's going through and then do the right thing for him or her?
In what ways are medical schools training doctors to do that? I mean, we're in a situation where doctors have so little time with patients to just diagnose medical issues, let alone all of the other things that go along with it. So what are some of the ways that people are being trained?
Medical students these days get a fairly healthy dose of what we call bioethics. Most of it comes formally in the earlier years when the students are still in the classroom. Then we try our best to incorporate it throughout the curriculum once they're on the wards. But the hope is if you give students familiarity with these sorts of issues, death and dying, medical errors, confidentiality, that if they learn this in the classroom, once they get on the wards, they're at least familiar with the issues and can try to deal with them as best as possible, even if there's limited amount of time.
You know, it's interesting. I've always thought that medical ethics initially were around things like the Tuskegee experiment and making sure things like that didn't happen again. And it seems like they've shifted from these kind of broad problems and issues down to, as you say, the very specific individual issues. Has that been a change? Is that fair to think that, or am I extrapolating something?
No,
there?
I think that the beginning of the field in the 1970s and 80s reflected a bunch of scandals, and medicine, the way it was practiced before that time, had to change. Doctors had too much power, researchers were taking advantage of human subjects, and there had to really be a sea change. And we see that now in things like ethics committees and institutional review boards, where some of the real outrageous things that happened in the past don't happen anymore. But that doesn't necessarily make it that easy on a day-to-day basis, because you get sort of these little ethical issues. You know, we know the broader outlines of how doctors should talk to patients, how people should be recruited into studies. But then when you get down to a specific case, the question remains, how do you do what's right for somebody?
And so how do you, I mean, as a physician, how much do you have to sit down and think about that when you're dealing with somebody who might have a difficult medical decision ahead of them?
Some of this comes into one's training. Whether you get some ethics as earlier on in medical school and you practice medicine and you watch some of the senior doctors and how they deal with patients in these circumstances. I like to think of ethical problems as something like a heart problem or a lung problem. As you're training, you need to get the knowledge and skills, just like you need to read an electrocardiogram. You should know the basics of the ethical issues. A patient, for example, is refusing a procedure that you think is necessary, or a patient is using hospital resources in a way that doesn't seem fair to other patients. Those sorts of things, you at least have a familiarity with them, and then you try to use the skills that you've acquired along the way to solve that. However, in the real difficult cases, just like you call a cardiology consult for the heart cases, there are ethics consults in hospitals who can help out as well.
Oh, interesting. I had not realized that there were people on staff who are there to do just that.
Yes. Yeah. So it varies from institution to institution, but certainly most places now have some kind of an ethics consult, ethics committee to help adjudicate the very, very difficult cases. But anybody like myself who sat in an ethics committee always likes to say we don't like to go around saying, you know, this is right, this is wrong. A lot of it often is facilitating communication among parties who have come into conflict because of a complicated and often tragic situation.
That brings up something that you brought up in your most recent column about the gun safety law in Florida, where basically physicians are prevented now by law from asking about gun safety, gun ownership, that sort of thing. So when laws like that come into play, how does that affect your ability to do your job?
You know, I teach about this issue. I'm teaching a class this semester on the history of public health, and the students and I were just debating recently, what can a doctor ask you about? Is there anything a doctor can ask you about? And maybe the one answer to that from my perspective is, who'd you vote for in the last election? But besides that, I think most things are fair game. If you're trying to help somebody and understand their living situation, understand the risks present at their home, asking about guns, for example, or psychiatric illnesses or sexual history should be fair game. So it's disconcerting to us when lawmakers tell us what we can and can't do.
Do you think some of individual people's reluctance to divulge some of those things are fears that they will enter into the public realm somehow, or that that information will be used against them in some way?
Sure. I think there's always a concern that what you're saying there could get out, that it's not a place where there's complete confidentiality. What we try to do, and certainly getting back to what we teach medical students, I give a lecture every year and we do a small group session on confidentiality, and I harangue them and say this is a sacred trust between the doctor and patient. What your patient says to you stays with you, and that way they'll trust you and be willing to tell you things they might not tell anybody else.
How does that translate, though, to doctors making notes and charts going to various? I mean, I think that's the legitimate fear with people that, okay, Dr. Lerner, you know, you're my physician and I'm telling you this and I know you're personally not going to tell anybody else. But what about all these other people who see that chart and who see that information? Do I have any real guarantee that I'm going to be okay by telling you this?
There's no guarantees.
Right.
And lots of people see the charts. Anyone who sees the charts officially has a confidentiality agreement, just like a doctor does. But as we all have heard, you know, through the media, big data is out there and people's records can get hacked. So technically, whatever is in a chart is accessible. To some degree, though, once we start leaving certain things out of charts and winking and nodding, then you're not going to be a good doctor, because I'm certainly not going to remember what I talked about. If you have hundreds of patients, you're not going to remember every detail of what you talked about with a patient. And if there's incomplete medical information, you're not doing people a service either. So we are walking this fine line between recording things but also trying to protect our patients.
Well, and also having, as you said, that sense of ethical responsibility that we have to each other, which I think is in some ways it's sort of human common sense, but we are a very litigious society too.
It's true. And, you know, doctors think about that. We do, and we want to try to do the right thing. But we understand documentation can be helpful, but it can also be a danger.
Do you think that we are in a stage where this kind of micromanagement of doctors' bedside manner is becoming more normal? Is this something that physicians are going to have to try to work with?
Oh, absolutely. We're in an era now where, due in part to the Affordable Care Act and other phenomena, we need to document everything we do, and we need to reach certain criteria in order to be labeled good doctors and good institutions and then potentially get financial rewards for doing that. So in my clinic, I try to be like an old country doctor, but it's pretty darn hard because I got to check off about 20 boxes. Did I talk about this? Did I get a blood test for that? It's difficult, and sometimes it depersonalizes the medicine. And I try to do the best I can to try to, at the same time, be meeting all those guidelines, but also spend at least part of the visit having a real human conversation and really understanding what's going on in my patients' lives.
Well, you also talk about permission, too, about certainly certain things, asking permission of the patient if it's okay. And, you know, I found myself thinking as I was reading that, well, you know, if I knew how to fix myself, I would do it. I wouldn't come to you. I would take care of it. So what is the permission piece of this?
Well, little did I know when I wrote that article that I would become the most hated person on the internet for a brief period of time. I was playing around in the article and asking the legitimate question, I think, is the doctor's job to try to force people politely and respectfully to do the things that the doctor believes is important for the patient's health, or should the patient be in charge? And the way I framed that was around this issue of permission. And the piece was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, although a lot of the readers didn't take it that way. And I took the approach that I'm going to push for my patients who I think are doing the wrong things and push on them for things like trying to get a better, healthier lifestyle, eat a healthier diet and things like that.
Stop smoking, lose weight.
Stop smoking, lose weight. And I'm going to – now, I'm not going to bully them, and I'm going to read their cues and back off if necessary. But I was saying that that was part of my job. Interestingly, many of the people who responded to the column online found that to be – I think some use the word Dr. Lerner's a bully. I would never want him to be my doctor. And I made the mistake of reading the comments, and it was a little perturbing to me. But I understand that. But I do worry that in an era particularly where we're checking off boxes, if all you want your doctor to do is like ask you questions and check off boxes, you're not having a very good doctor-patient relationship.
Exactly. And it's like I said, I could like go on the internet and go to WebMD and diagnose myself. And we all know that that probably isn't the best way to take care of myself. That's why we have doctors. That's why you went through medical school. That's why you went through however many years of specialty training.
Exactly. And you know, the column that I wrote was, you know, it was a bit of a wake-up call for me. And I've actually self-scrutinized more since I wrote it and watching how I'm bringing up these issues. And I'm trying to do it in as respectful a way as possible. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think I want to indicate to people and make sure at least they know and have thought about ways they can alter their behaviors and lifestyles that might create a healthier situation.
Well, and the other thing I'm thinking as we're talking about this is that we're all individuals. So you can have a set of guidelines as a physician about, yes, you know, be aware. But we all have individual personalities, and we all have ways that we interact with each other that are different from somebody else. You may do it differently than I might do it. And so do we have to make sure that there's room for that kind of individuality?
Absolutely. I think one of the great skill sets of being a doctor, and I'm not claiming to be the best at this at all, but it's something I pay attention to and it's something I teach about, is to read your patient's body language. If you have 10 patients, for example, who are smokers, let's just say, you're not going to talk about quitting smoking with those 10 people in the same way at all. You're going to look at their history of smoking, look at whether they've tried to quit in the past, look at their inclination to want to quit, and then you're going to craft a a plan for them and start a discussion that's going to reflect their particular individual life situations. That's the art of being a really good doctor. Does it always work? Of course not. But I think patients respect that when you're paying attention to who they are and how they reply to you when you're crafting these sorts of strategies.
Is there also, do you think, a reluctance? Doctors have often been seen sort of as paternalistic, you know, telling people what's good for them and then go do it. And it sounds like what you're saying is that you still know what's good. It's just you have to craft a different way to tell folks.
Yeah, and one way I do that is to look at the medical literature, right? So some of what I do as part of my job is try to learn the recent literature, whether it's on smoking cessation or weight loss or healthier diets, and make sure that people know about it. And so then at least if I'm talking about the data and my understanding of the data, it's less judgmental. And I'm really not coming in and saying being obese makes you a bad person. I'm saying that if you lost some weight, you'd feel better potentially. You have a healthier lifestyle. You might live longer. Your blood pressure might go down. You might get off some of your pills. So this is at least something we should talk about.
As you think about ethics and write about them in the Times and other places, what are some of the ways that you think people misunderstand what medical ethics are and what they should be doing?
Well, I think that some people hear the term bioethics and ethicists and worry that a lot of people who do that are sort of in an ivory tower and making decisions and don't have their finger on the pulse. And, you know, there's a lot of, we mentioned Tuskegee before, I still think among certain populations there's a suspicion or resentment about people in medical centers telling certain populations what's good for them and what's not. So to the degree that people who do bioethics are sensitive to cultural issues, sensitive to issues of class, sensitive to issues of gender, and come in again to try to facilitate a better conversation and to really understand the goals of the patients and the families involved. If you start at that point, things are usually going to progress in a constructive way, as opposed to coming in and saying, which ethicists don't do, but coming in and saying, I'm the ethicist, I was called in to decide what we have to do here. No ethicist would say this, but I think sometimes members of the public think that that's what we're trying to do.
And trying to prescribe behavior, prescribe ways of thinking. And I think that probably is what a lot of people resist is that don't tell me what to think or how to think it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And again, the balance between constructive suggestions, a little bit of arm twisting, and information dissemination can go a long way if it's done appropriately.
So will you ever read the comments on columns again, or are you just saying, no, I'm just not going to go there?
No, I'll always read them.
You know, I find them interesting. I mean, sometimes they're just vitriolic and,
yes,
and awful, but sometimes you really learn something.
No, I really learned from this. I wrote the column, and I wrote it in a certain way. As I said before, there was a little tongue-in-cheek, and I didn't think was overbearing, and I thought covered both sides of the issue, and at least a small segment of the readership. And I think it was a distinctive segment of the readership who struggled for years and years with issues of weight, and the headline of the article didn't really help, who took what I said in a very, very negative way. But what I learned from that was instead of like excoriating those people who I felt were a little bit too thin-skinned, was to be more careful about how I write things and to understand and to remind myself that when you talk about certain complicated topics, for example, like weight, you have to, as a commentator, be that much more careful to explore the language that you're using to discuss it.
And do you take those lessons also now into the examining room with your patients?
Yeah, yes and no. I'm more or less still doing the same. I don't think I was doing anything wrong, frankly, from the start. But as I said before, at least in the first few weeks after the comments, I was watching myself and listening to what I was saying more. And I've made some subtle changes, I think, in trying to make sure that my patients understand that I am not proscribing what they have to do. I'm trying to make helpful suggestions what they might consider doing.
Which is, I think, what we all want when we go to our doctors.
I would think so.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lerner, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for being here and willing to talk with us.
I enjoyed it very much.
Author Baron Lerner is a doctor and a professor of medicine and population health at New York University. His latest book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. He spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie Northwall in Milwaukee to give the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
A short break now, and then we'll meet a Milwaukee woman who is concerned that the characters in her children's books didn't look like her children. She decided that making change could start with crafting her own children's book, and we'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. A children's television special made a splash last month. It was based on the classic children's picture book, The Snowy Day. That book itself made waves when it was published in 1962 because it was one of the very few at the time to feature an African-American child as its main character.
More than 50 years later, children of color are still the exception when it comes to characters in picture books. That bothered Milwaukee's Deanna Singh, who has worked in a number of roles at foundations in the area.
And so she decided it was time to add the title Children's Book Author to her CV. Her new book is called I Am a Boy of Color, and she came by the Lake Effect studio to share the backstory of, well, the story. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
So you have done a lot of things over the years, but children's book author was never one of them until now. So what inspired you to change that? Why did you write this?
Sure. I actually never, you know, set out to be a children's book author. This happened. I tell people this actually came to me. So I was listening and looking and seeing all these things happening in the world. And really, it was frustrating to me as a parent of two small brown boys. I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old. And I just saw this like perpetuation of negative images of our children. And so one day I was just completely overwhelmed by this feeling. And I actually sat down and took that feeling of distress, I guess, and wrote this letter to my boys. You know, it was essentially a love letter. Like, here are all the things I want you to see when your dad and I are not around. And I put it in a PDF and I put the kids' pictures on it. I thought I had really done something awesome and I was going to give that as a Valentine's Day gift. But then I started doing some more research, Mitch, and I saw what was really happening in children's literature. And what I found is that children in 2015, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, for example, did a study, and they found that of all the books released in 2015, only 14% of those books had any children of color in them, compared to 73.3% of those books reflecting white children. And as an avid reader, as a family that loves literature, I just thought that that was unacceptable. And so I looked back at this, you know, PDF that I had created for my children and thought, is this an opportunity to really talk to all of our children? You know, and I read it, I thought, this is a message. This is how I feel about all of our kids. So why not walk into the space and see if we couldn't make it into a book?
Had it ever dawned on you as you would read to your children that they were not seeing themselves in the characters that were on the pages?
It did. You know, I think one of the things that we are very conscientious parents, you know, we try to be. And so we went out and intentionally tried to find books that did that. But one day I was going to sleep, and in the middle of the night, I woke up in a panic, right? Because I thought, oh my goodness, do the bookshelves that are in our house that are overflowing, like what would the percentage look like in our own bookshelves? And so I pulled out my phone and I started buying books. And I think I bought 28 books that night, you know, in the middle, like 3 o'clock in the morning. And they were books with scientists and, you know, books that had all of these educators, and there were books with superheroes in them. But all of the books had little boys of color, because I want my children to be able to see that they could do any one of those things.
Boys of color in particular.
Yes. You know, for me, it's all children of color. I've dedicated my entire life to trying to make sure that we create opportunities for children. In this particular instance, at least where we started, was a message that I had for my own boys. But the thing that I love about the book is that I see girls responding to it just as much as the boys. We've gotten a lot of pressure to think about I Am a Girl of Color, and we're definitely going to do it. But that's at least where we started.
How do you think your boys respond to this message? And first of all, did you ever give them the PDF?
I did give them the PDF, and I actually gave them the initial copy of the book, and they were really involved all along the way. So when Amar, who's our amazing illustrator, would give us some pictures, sometimes the boys would go with me, and they would come and look at the pictures. They're the ones who decided there's a kind of a middle part of the book. They're the ones who decided what that middle turning point in the book would look like. So they had a lot of decision-making, actually, along the way.
The boys that are pictured in this book are of a variety of ethnicities too.
Exactly. You know, the idea is that we want to make sure that all children, no matter what shade they are, can find themselves in literature. And so this book is a real reflection of the diversity, the beautiful diversity that we have in our world. So you see all different kinds of ethnic backgrounds represented.
Right. The point is not just that African-American children are not represented in the book or Latino children are not represented in books, but this is a much broader societal issue that you're talking about.
That's right. That's right.
At the end of the day, what do you hope your young readers take from the message of this book?
So there are essentially two things that we're hoping to achieve through the book. The first thing is that we want as many children as possible to actually physically have the book in their hands. And the reason why we want that is because the book is full of just self-affirmation. You know, it uses words like proud. It uses words like honor. And so we want to make sure that children have that as a resource and parents and educators have that as a resource for them. So obviously, many, you know, kids as possible can see and read those words of affirmation. The second actually intention kind of goes back to my boys. So as parents, we decided that we were going to take some of the proceeds of the book and put them into a foundation. So we're calling it the Flying Elephant Foundation.
Right. And where does that name come from?
So the idea of flying elephant is, you know, an elephant is a beautiful, majestic creature. It has cultural significance for me. I'm African American and also Asian Indian. You know, it is. And so the idea of flying is that how do you take something that's beautiful and majestic and transformative and then actually give it wings? So that's the concept of Flying Elephant. The foundation, actually, that's the company side of it, but the foundation side of it is run not by me, but by my two children. So Zephaniah is 8 and Zion is 4. They love to point out that they are the co-chairman of the foundation. And that really gets to the second point of the book, right, is that we know that this book, and we hope that this book will be a positive and have a positive impact on the lives of young people. But we also know that this book alone isn't going to change the trajectory, right? This book alone is going to be part of a much bigger opportunity. And so the foundation, the goal of the foundation is to take those proceeds and then reinvest them into other projects that are focused on really promoting the idea of our children, right? And promoting the idea of positive self-images of our kids. So those are the two goals. And I see this book really resonating with people on both of those aspects.
And one of the things that really stuck with me after I read this book was the message both to your readers to see themselves as individuals and to the rest of the world to see them as individuals and not just boys of color.
Exactly. You know, I think one of the lines on the back of the book is, "Please see me." And I think that that's really important because I think the boys in themselves, they have to carry around a self-image that allows them to live in a space that unfortunately right now is really convoluted with a lot of negative images, right? So it takes a lot to have that internal affirmation. But there's also this other piece of the book that's saying, hey, world, look at me. I'm a kid that's joyful. I'm a kid that's intelligent. I'm a kid that's creative. And I need you, when you look at me, to not just see my color because it's beautiful, but don't just see my color. Also see the other aspects of me that make me a unique human being. And isn't that what we want to happen for everybody?
How, aside from going on programs like this one, how are you getting this book into the hands of the kids that would benefit from reading it?
So one of the things that we've been trying to do is really make sure that we're reaching out into the networks that we have here in the community. And just as I didn't set out to be a children's book author, I also, you know, am still learning, like, how does distribution work? And, you know, how do you reach your...
You've never been a book publicist.
I've never. I'm adding all kinds of different, you know, skill sets to my portfolio here going through this experience. And so we're really looking to the people in the community to help us get the word out. And, you know, we had a book launch on this past week, and it was fantastic. We had over 200 people come and show their support. And it's through those networks that anything that has happened with this book has really come to fruition.
Tell us a little bit more about the person who illustrated this.
Yes. So Amar Nasormo is this amazing award-winning artist that we are so lucky to have here in Milwaukee. He has done great, you know, projects all over the city. I think one of the things people most know him by is the bridge, the McKinley Bridge. Mm-hmm. He actually did those pieces underneath there. Just gorgeous. Gorgeous art. Amar looked at this project, and initially, we joke that initially he said no to me. Like, he had so many other things that he was engaged in. But then he decided that he would do the project because, in his words, I didn't want anybody to mess it up. And he was absolutely right. And I was adamant that he was going to be the person, because once I saw how well he was able to capture real-looking children, I didn't want anybody else to participate. So...
How does this book relate to the rest of the work that you have done throughout your career?
You know, I have always looked for opportunities to really try and change the narrative, whether it's around children of color, whether it's around how people view our city or people view challenges. And so for me, this book is really an extension of what I consider to be my sole mission in life, which is how do you use the opportunities, the experiences that you have, and really take those to elevate other things, right? Other social justice issues. There's a social entrepreneur spirit that I have inside of me. And so I always joke, like, I'm a chronic founder, right? I'm a builder. I'm a chronic builder. So my MO is I see something that's a problem, or I see something that's frustrating. And, you know, in this case, the fact that there was all these negative images and so few positive images. And then I try and figure out a way to solve it or be part of the solution. And I think that is where this book came from. It was a deep passion for our young people and our city, and even beyond just here, just across the world as we think about different ways to connect as humans.
The book has only been out for a short time, but now that you have children's book author under your belt as a title, is this something that are you thinking there might be more down the road?
Definitely. I think we are committed to doing I Am a Girl of Color. You know, I think one of the things that we're trying to do here is be part of this other larger movement. So whether it's even just a book from me, I'm also really interested in trying to figure out ways to support other authors who have been in this space for longer, or even those who are entering the space. And that's been a very fun aspect of it. So I'm not sure what it will turn into, but there are certainly lots of ideas that I have about how we continue to engage this art form, quite frankly, or this platform in a way that really allows us to do some of this other social justice work.
Now, I apologize because I didn't ask you this beforehand, but could I talk you into reading this book for us?
Of course. So I will start by saying that this book is actually dedicated to Justin, my husband, Zephaniah, and Zion, my children, and all the little boys of color that are making the world brighter. When I look into the mirror, I see creativity, an image of all that could be. When I look into a mirror, I see possibility, the range of my ability. When I look into a mirror, I see love for others and also for me. When I look into a mirror, I see honor, images of those who came before me. When I look into a mirror, I see joy, smiles, laughter, and giggles galore. When I look into a mirror, I see intelligence, a thirst for knowledge. When I look into a mirror, I see a reflection of God. I am his child. What do you see when you look at me? Please, see me. I am unique. I am free. I am caring. I am proud. I am happy. I am smart. I am a boy of color.
Deanna Singh, it's wonderful stuff. Thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
Deanna Singh is a lot of things: the president of the Doman Company Foundation, the chief change agent for Flying Elephant, and the author of the new children's book, I Am a Boy of Color. You can find a link to more about it from WUWM.com.
One more break now, and then we'll consider how the family meal could have a positive impact on your life in 2017. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. When you think back on your childhood, what did dinner time look like?
Many of us might think back on meals eaten around the kitchen or dining room tables in idyllic terms: good food, conversation, and togetherness. While the reality might have been a little more nuanced, there was a time when the family meal was a pretty typical shared experience in America.
But for many families, even just married couples, the experience of sitting down together over an uninterrupted meal is increasingly rare. Couples work different shifts, kids have nighttime activities, and even the most well-meaning among us are sometimes interrupted at mealtime by an urgent email or text message.
The editors of Taste of Home magazine would like you to reconsider the importance of the family meal in 2017. The Milwaukee-based company's new cookbook, 100 Family Meals, is subtitled Bringing the Family Back to the Dinner Table.
Editor Mark Hagen is with us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So many of us, when it comes to New Year's resolutions and food, often those resolutions involve less food. But I gather one of the ideas behind this is if you're thinking about changing something to do with food in the coming year, it actually involves making more of it, and making being the key word.
You're absolutely right. At Taste of Home, we thought, why not make a new type of resolution? And that's a resolution to your family. So this year, make a resolution to have sit-down dinners with your family at least 100 times this year. Now, that sounds like a lot, but that really only averages out to about 2 times per week.
Well, and so let's talk about the significance of the family dinner, because, you know, people might think, okay, well, you know, I stick the chicken nuggets in the oven and we sit down and we eat and we get up and go about our business. What's wrong with that paradigm?
Nothing really. I mean, the idea is that you're sitting down with your family and eating. So the meal itself isn't necessarily the main problem or objective. What you want to do is sit down together, talk about your day, open up communications, make memories, things like that. So the meal isn't as important. However, like you said, all too often, because we're so busy, kids are busier these days. We have families where the parents perhaps live in different homes. So we do get stuck in that chicken nugget routine. Whereas this new book, 100 Family Meals, does offer a lot of easy, quick ideas for today's families.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, you kind of lay out in the beginning of this book some ground rules for what a family dinner should feel like. What should be there? What shouldn't be there? Talk a little bit about what the ground rules you see are good for these kinds of family meals.
Setting ground rules is a great idea. This book does offer, there's a little sidebar with some ideas. I think there's 3 great ideas to stick with. The first is no cell phones, no notepads, no devices at the table. Really use this time to concentrate on your family. The second idea is to avoid any very stressful subjects. So if there's a problem with the kids not fixing their bed in the morning, maybe this isn't the time to bring that up. You want to have a nice, welcoming environment. And the third idea is wait until everybody's at the table to start eating. This way nobody misses anything, and it makes that family dinner more of an event.
What do you think we've lost from not doing this more often? What's at stake here?
I think what we found, and various studies have proven this, and we talk about these in the book a little bit, is that children who eat regularly together with their families, there's more of a sense of commitment. There's more of a sense of responsibility. They know they're going to have to answer to their parents for their actions. And there's also more memories to be made. So I think that when we don't have these family meals, kids tend to feel like they can get away with more. And the studies actually indicate that they realize they can't get away with quite as much when they know they have to sit down with mom and dad at dinner time.
Do you think that should the rest of the family, besides the whoever does most of the cooking at home, should more people be involved in the front end of this, the making of the food too?
If you get the whole family involved in cooking the meal, it's much easier to hit your mark of 2 family meals per week. But bringing the kids into the kitchen actually does more than that. It really is a great opportunity to teach them about nutrition, to teach them life skills about cooking, and it really actually gets them excited to sit down as a family and enjoy a meal together. It also gets your kids interested in eating different foods. So if you have a picky eater, take him or her shopping and let them pick out a new piece of produce. They'll be more excited to try that. Same thing, if they're helping you create the meal in the kitchen, they're more excited to sit down and enjoy that meal together.
So that said, the 100 meals in this book kind of cover a wide variety of, you know, they come from different backgrounds. What holds them all together?
Well, a couple of things. All of the recipes that you'll find in 100 Family Meals were shared by real families. So these recipes come from today's home cooks. This is what they're serving in their households. So I think that's one thing that brings them all together. The other thing that I like about this is that they're all easy, they're simple. I actually chose these recipes myself with the idea that you can make them on a busy weeknight. There's 183 recipes total. That counts as side dishes and desserts and whatnot. And I think something like 85 of them are ready in 30 minutes or less.
You wouldn't anticipate that most people would start at page one and work their way through it over the course of the year.
You can flip through that book. The entrees, the 100 entrees, are divided up by chicken, beef, pork, etc. Every single entree comes with a goes great with tip. So if you're looking at a pork chop, for instance, you'll see a little box that says, hey, here's an idea for a quick side dish. Sometimes those are recipes within the book, and sometimes they're just pick this up on the way home at the grocery store.
And you said you personally picked all the recipes that make up this book. What makes a good recipe for you? I mean, they're submitted by real live people out there. Do you look at these and say, oh my God, how could that possibly work?
All of our recipes, they come in from home cooks across the country, and then they're tested in the Taste of Home test kitchen. To make sure that they work, to make sure that they look nice, that they taste good. We have a wonderful tasting panel. So that's really, to me, what makes a great recipe is that it tastes good. When I chose these, I was really thinking of families. So all the recipes you're going to see in here have family appeal. Some are maybe geared towards families with smaller children. Some are geared towards families with teens or preteens. But overall, they really have a strong family appeal.
You also, for some of the meals, you actually kind of create grocery lists for people to, I mean, it really takes a lot of the guesswork out of it.
That's right. At the end of every chapter, you'll find several grocery lists. It's actually, you'll find menus for 3-item meals. And then each of those is in a clip and keep grocery list. So you can actually take that to the grocery store and there you have your whole meal right there.
So, yeah, for example, we're in the seafood and meatless section. One of the meals is lemon parsley baked cod as the entree, tortellini primavera soup as the side, and toffee pecan bars. And right next to it is the grocery list.
Yes,
for that.
Easy, easy, easy.
The other thing that jumped out at me, actually, is, you know, you were talking about the need to kind of leave those stressful conversations behind. And so then you might ask, what will replace those stressful conversations? You have even taken the guesswork about out of what to talk about.
This is one of my favorite things about this cookbook. And actually, this makes this cookbook different than anything else you'll find on the market. Throughout the book, you'll find conversation starters. So if you're sitting at the dinner table and you want to start a conversation, look up one of the conversation starters. For example, who was your favorite cartoon character? That's a great conversation for all ages to share around the table. We might talk about what's your favorite side dish at Thanksgiving. Doesn't matter if it's July and you're having this conversation. Everyone has a favorite side dish at Thanksgiving. So you'll find all these conversation starters throughout the book, and it'll really help you enjoy that time at the dinner table.
The conversation starter that, and I can't find it right now, I was just trying to page through it, but that jumped out at me is, if you could start a radio show, who would you have on it? And I thought it would start with the person that edited this book.
Oh, well, thank you. That is a great answer.
So what are, again, you chose the recipes here. What are some of the ones that sort of surprised you that you included in this book that, you know, if someone were to pick it up off the shelf, might surprise them?
Right now, actually, when I chose the recipes, I found one called muffin tin lasagnas. And they're little mini lasagnas that are made in a muffin tin. And back when I chose these recipes, cooking in muffin tins wasn't as hot as it is right now, because that is a big thing right now. Kids love it. People in general just like mini individual servings. So I think the muffin tin lasagnas are one that really stand out to me.
And by honest to God coincidence, I will share that that was the recipe that jumped out in the Teich household. That was a recipe when the book arrived, we made that one first.
Awesome. And how was it?
It came out I could show you a picture of it, except that I do not have my phone in here because I'm treating this like a family meal.
And that's what I love about the Taste of Home books in general, is that they are all tested. So you know they are going to turn out. And the method is fairly simple. Anybody can put these together.
Now, I guess I hadn't realized that muffin cooking in muffin tins is as hot as it is.
It is. It is a hot trend. I think it goes back to just the smaller individual portions. I think that kids like it. And very, very often, not every time, but very often, things that cook in muffin tins freeze well. So you can pop those little lasagnas out of the muffin tin, for example, and freeze them individually for future meals.
What about technique? Because that's, I think, another thing that might keep some people out of the kitchen. How accessible is the technique required to make these dishes?
You're absolutely right. That is one of the things that people struggle with when they're trying to cook sit-down meals for their families. Technique is important. And when these recipes were chosen for the book, that was really part of the selection process, that anybody could put these together. So you're going to find 30-minute meals in here. You're going to find slow cooker dishes. I mean, slow cookers are really a perfect tool for today's family cooks. When they want something, they don't have a lot of time, a little bit of planning, you can get that slow cooker going and come home to a great meal.
They are kind of a minor miracle in that way.
People, and they're hot right now. They're hot, hot, hot. In fact, in the book, we mark the slow cook dishes with a little icon so you can find them easily as you're paging through it. Things that freeze well, too. You know, we give you some freezer options. So those are little tricks that you can follow if you want to serve more sit-down family meals.
What about prepping early on, doing things like getting the ingredients ready early in the week?
You sure can. I think one of the great things about Taste of Home is that we use items that people probably already have in their kitchens or in their pantries. So the prep should be pretty simple, but our prep and cook times are listed with every single recipe.
As are nutrition facts, which struck me as, you know, for people who are especially looking for fiber or counting their calories or carbs or whatever.
Every single recipe in this book does have a complete set of nutrition facts. You are correct. When people started cooking more at home, they were looking for special dietary needs. But I think that nowadays, we have all these young moms out there, and even if they're not following a certain diet, they just want to know if they're serving their family healthy foods. So we included a complete set of nutrition facts throughout the book so that you always know what you're cooking up at home.
So after we get through making these 100 meals, is there a sequel to come?
I hope so. I really hope that this becomes a huge effort across the country to sit down with your family and prepare at least 100 family meals. We're asking everybody to take pictures of their family meals. Tell us about what recipes you make and use the hashtag 100 family meals to do so. So you can see what other family cooks are sharing and maybe share some recipes, share some conversation starters that you enjoyed or that you created yourself. So hashtag 100 family meals is really a great idea, I think, and it might just start something across the country.
Well, Mark Hagen, thank you so much for starting the conversation in here, and hope we'll see you again.
Thank you very, very much.
Mark Hagen is managing editor of print and digital books at Milwaukee-based Taste of Home. He's also editor of the new book 100 Family Meals, Bringing the Family Back to the Dinner Table. You'll find a link to more about it from WUWM.com.
Finally today, we look back at some of our best in-studio performances of the last year over the holidays, but there were so many in the archives we did not have room for all of them, so we take a moment on today's show to revisit a performance from the duo of Adrian plus Meredith and a song they played for us called Fixer.
Devil of a woman, yeah. She keeps demons swinging around for you at home. Crank the fan and I watch the wind blow, wind blow.
Now I got a firefighting engine, folks, a firefighting engine. When my patience goes thin, it starts to show. Too many us, not enough, maybe you're now, maybe you're now, maybe you're now, maybe you're now, yeah, maybe you're now. No, my life, no, my life. Be the worst coming up around the bend, around the bend, around the bend, in bitter times. Did five things, they all did offend our right. We found a fixer down on the West End. Where my patience grows thin and it starts to show. Too many, it's not enough, maybe you're no, maybe you're no, maybe you're no, maybe you're no, sir. You bring the cheese and I bring the wine. You bring dessert, I bring dining entertainment show, yeah. It's a grab the snare, you bring the cymbal. Nothing wrong with another occupational joke. Just another occupational joke. Oh my life, oh my. Feel the worst coming up around the bend, round the bend, round the bend, and round the bend, yeah, round the bend, round the bend, round the bend. Did five things, they all did a bend, all right. Seen the way she walks running away. Well, look beyond all the message giving she gave to me, gave to me, gave to me, yeah, gave to me. But I'm not a man begrudging, no, no. No, I'm not a man for cussing, but freaking ain't. Well, she left them on the day to winter, told her to stay, told her to stay. No, no my life, no, my life. Feel the worst coming up around the bend, around the bend, around the bend, in better times. Did five things, still did a bend, all right.
Stevens Point native Adrian Krigowski and his wife Meredith are the duo Adrian plus Meredith. And that song from a Lake Effect session was called Fixer. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another episode of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.